Welcome to the Social Science of War. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We bring together scholars and practitioners to better understand warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. The views expressed in this episode do not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. We hope you enjoy the show. When civil-military relations is taught at West Point, we often focus on the military side of the equation. Most discussions center around questions of how to ensure officers submit and defer to civilian control. Dr. Ron Krebs' research focuses on the civilian side of the equation. His research finds Americans are increasingly deferential to the judgment of military leadership regarding the use of force. Additionally, Americans are seemingly undisturbed by active duty officers and retired military leaders publicly intervening in policy debates. On the other hand, Dr. Scott Limbacher teaches civil-military relations to future Army officers at West Point. Scott finds the principal-agent bureaucratic framework as a useful lens for thinking about civ-mil dynamics. He has a knack for challenging civ-mil assumptions and encourages officers to avoid distilling complex theories into convenient catchphrases that often obscure their meaning. Today, Dr. Ron Krebs helps us understand new trends in civil-military relations and why they are antithetical to healthy, democratic norms. What can and should military officers do to stop this trend? What about civilian and political leaders? Dr. Scott Limbacher asks us to consider whether we've oversimplified the concept of civilian leaders' right to be wrong, and helps us compare and contrast the political appointee and senior military officer approval processes. Dr. Krebs has published a great deal on civil-military relations, and we've provided our listeners to his work in this field in the show notes. Today's discussion primarily focuses on a study he co-authored in Perspectives on Politics, titled, No Right to Be Wrong, What Americans Think About Civil-Military Relations. Dr. Limbacher will mostly comment on an article he co-authored in Lawfare, titled, Senate Confirmation is a Recipe for Politicizing Military Personnel Policy. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Ron Krebs and Scott Limbacher. All right, as I said in our intro, my guests today are Dr. Scott Limbacher and Dr. Ron Krebs. Ron, if you could introduce yourself and then kick it to Scott, if you want to introduce yourself, a little bit about what you do and how you got interested in civ-mil.
My name is Ron Krebs. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Minnesota. And I've been interested in broadly in the relationship between military and society, essentially for as long as I can remember. We're going to be talking a bit about some of the research I've been doing in the last few years. But my very first book was about military service and the politics of citizenship. That is broadly about how do and when do minority groups succeed in using military service to achieve first-class citizenship for themselves. So this has long been an area of interest, and I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Gabe.
Thank you, Ron. And Scott?
So I am far much more newer to civ-mil relations. I come to political science broadly looking at federal agencies and how federal agencies can be politicized and the consequences that politicization of agencies have. And when I got to West Point, I was asked to teach the Intro to American Politics course. And that course has a civ-mil component that was an entirely new literature to me. However, I found many parallels between what was being discussed in the literature and what I studied across all other agencies. And so much of what I look at the civ-mil problem through is a lens towards how the federal government runs more generally, with the Department of Defense being a very large, but one of 15 cabinet departments, and you know, under constraints that are similar to other agencies. And so that's sort of the worldview that I approach this question with as I'm starting to enter into this literature.
Excellent to have two very different perspectives. Looking forward to it. Okay, so for starters, I think it is valuable to ground our discussion in a common understanding of what we mean when we say that there is a general agreement around the idea that civilian politicians and officials have this right to be wrong. Ron, we'll start with you. What does the right to be wrong mean to you? And why is that so critical to our ideal model of civil-military relations in a democracy?
To understand the right to be wrong, which is an expression that to which we owe the sort of the neat formulation of Peter Feaver of Duke University, we have to start with our basic understanding of democratic theory. At the heart of democracy, our conventional conception of democracy is rooted in the folk wisdom. The democracy means government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Scholarship on democracy has raised lots of questions about that basic folk wisdom and that notion of responsiveness. At the heart of any conception of democracy must be the reality, though, of critical decisions being made in ways that are accountable to the people, so that even if people don't know their will ahead of time, don't elect figures who necessarily represent their interests, they can punish decision makers for making bad decisions. That is fundamental to the idea that civilians have the right to be wrong, because they, either directly because they're elected officials or indirectly because they are appointed by elected officials, they have accountability to voters in a way that military officials are much more indirectly accountable, and really not particularly directly accountable to the people. The idea that civilians have the right to be wrong means that on the largest questions about when to use force, and even how to use force, about questions of strategy, which is really our theory of victory, about how do we align military means and political ends, that civilians are the ones, those who are accountable to people, are the ones who are making those fundamental decisions. That does not mean that they will always make good decisions. One of the lessons of the Iraq War may be that civilians have the right to be wrong, but when they are wrong, watch out. Democratic civil-military relations is not just about the right to be wrong, however. It is also, as Elliot Cohen once memorably put it, an unequal dialogue. That with rights always come responsibilities. And part of that responsibility is that civilians have a responsibility to listen to those who are expert in the application of military force, that is, military officers. They have to listen to that military advice, take it into account, not follow it slavishly, and then make their own decisions.
Excellent. Broadly bringing it back to democratic civ-mil norms, I think framing that really well for us. Thank you. Scott, I think you have a really interesting take on the right to be wrong. As a bit of an oversimplified and maybe perhaps misleading bumper sticker or catchphrase, like maybe we are, by just repeating this phrase and just telling, whether it's you and I teaching cadets or other officers in training, hey, civilians have the right to be wrong, that we're maybe missing the full picture of Beaver, and or could be like a poor way to teach it if we just leave it at that. Can you elaborate on that and kind of give us your perspective there?
Yeah, no problem at all. I think, you know, this is taken out of an academic article. It's a very well-formed position to get to the phrase, the civilians have a right to be wrong. I think it's interesting. It's a right versus the right, how we framed it sometimes, which can imply a, you know, choice set of rights that civilians have, or is there just one right that civilians have? But punting on sort of the little grammatical difference there, you know, the paragraph that precedes this last sentence, it's the concluding sentence in the Fever article, talks about Plato's philosopher king. It talks about how the military has really the ability to be an expert, but not the judge. And so, you know, the lead up just before that sentence, or the claim of the civilians have a right to be wrong, is, you know, the military quantifies the risk and the civilian judges it. Regardless of how superior the military view of a situation might be, the civilian view trumps it. Civilians should get what they ask for, even if it's not what they really want. And to Ron's point, that's framing it around democratic norms. It actually is suggesting the military has no seat at the table here in the ultimate decision. Now, yes, there's an unequal dialogue, but the frame here is that the choice is that of the civilians and only the civilians. And what I worry about is that sort of nuance that leads up to the point, that leads up to saying civilians have the right to be wrong or make a call that goes against military expertise, is that it can imply different things about where the military's role and is with this decision making. So if civilians have a right to be wrong, is the implication then that the military does not have a right to be wrong? I think it can also go to perversely, it can metastasize to a point where the military is not wrong. Its decisions are coming from expertise and they're technocratic in the what they reach. And anything that deviates from that, well, now the military is not responsible for its actions any longer. I think that's where oversimplification can lead us astray, is that if we view this as civilians have a right to be wrong, They chose something counter to my advice. Therefore, anything that goes wrong is because you deviated from my plan. And there's no other counterfactual. I think that's where we can get into a slippery slope with democratic accountability and the military's role in society, is if it becomes an unassailable opinion that whatever the military says is infallible, it's correct, and it's something that we can't challenge.
I think that segues quite nicely into beginning to look at Ron's work. The title of the article I mostly want to talk about amongst your research, Ron, is No Right to Be Wrong. And it's this idea that when we look at public opinion polling amongst civilians, on the civmil side of the equation, that you found some interesting trends as it relates to deference to military authority instead of that civilian authority. But you begin the article in kind of setting the stage in the winter of 2017. So what was significant about that time as a backdrop for your research?
Thanks, Gabe. I think there's sort of two really important things that I would note about this period in the second half of the 2010s. Obviously, we start the story in 2017. The poll that we're going to be talking about was conducted in 2019 and then another one in 2021. Donald Trump, of course, is elected to office in 2016. He enters office in January of 2017. And Trump, in ways that it's easy to forget, Trump enters office already contravening basic norms of civil-military relations, with constant references to my generals. Trump, who did not serve in the military, who we know evaded military service during Vietnam, as so many people did, Donald Trump swathes himself and appoints more former generals to the cabinet than anyone had before him. And as we will come to see over the next 4 years, Trump contravenes all sorts of norms of democratic civil-military relations. He goes and gives speeches before military audiences that transforms them into a political rally. He seeks to use the military as a prop that's not unique to Trump, but he does it more than anybody else. The larger backstory here is the story of the polarization, the partisan polarization of American politics that has been building for the last 25 to 30 years before Donald Trump enters office. And that partisan backdrop, this the sorting of American politics into tribes, the decline of bipartisanship, which we can easily romanticize and idealize, but in certain critical ways was real. All of that is sort of a critical backdrop to the transformation and the challenges that American civil-military relations has faced in 2017, in 2019, and faces today.
It's interesting you say that. When I teach one of our CivMil lessons, an intro to American politics, which is mostly second-year cadets, I show them Lieutenant General retired Mike Flynn's speech at the Republican National Convention, and then I show them General John Allen's speech endorsing Secretary Clinton at the Democratic National Convention. And it's absolutely fascinating hearing their takes and how do we parse whether or not those kinds of partisan statements are okay. I want to read a quote from your article. You say, public opinion thus features in the background of Fevers, talking about Peter Fevers' theory. The less the public buys into civilian supremacy, the greater are the potential costs of disciplining shirking military officers. The less likely civilians then are to punish them, and the less effectively civilian monitoring then produces military compliance. So based on this, measuring public opinion of this deference to authority should be a critical indicator of the state of civil military norms that we look at. So you fielded the survey in 2021, meant to replicate questions from a comprehensive survey on CivMil that was originally conducted between 1998 and 1999. So what did you find regarding Americans' feelings about civilian supremacy? And more broadly, why do you think public opinion is such an important aspect when we look at CivMil?
Great questions. So remember, I said a few minutes ago, there are two fundamental basic challenges to democratic civil-military relations, and one that we rarely talk about. Your cadets get training in civil-military relations. They at least have some exposure to civil-military relations. But civilians get zero training in civil-military relations. They never think about it, right, until they are faced with it. And the great danger then to civil-military relations, to democratic civil-military relations, is deference. the concern that simply civilians will simply do whatever it is that military officers tell them because they are the experts. And in part because they are the product of the same American political culture that venerates military officers. And we have now fascinating experimental evidence showing us that people think that military officers are expert on all kinds of things, well beyond the use of force. So we went into this research really wanting to get at this notion of deference. And what we realized actually is that the ways in which polling questions have been posed in the past were not very helpful. The only question that is asked regularly in polls is the general question of confidence or trust in the armed forces. But again, they weren't posing the questions that really got at deference. And so we posed our questions in the following way. We asked people, if senior U.S. military officers object to a proposed military mission, should the president reject the proposed mission, even if the president thinks the mission worthwhile? Or should he reject the proposed mission only if the president agrees the mission is not worthwhile? Democratic civil military relations would say that the president should follow their own judgment. Once they've listened to the military and taken that into account, it is fundamentally their decision. We found, and we've run this survey a couple of times now, roughly half of our US-based respondents think that the president should reject the proposed mission even if the president thinks the mission is worthwhile. If we frame that same question in the affirmative rather than in the negative, that is, if we say, if senior U.S. military officers approve of a proposed military mission, should the president approve the proposed mission, even if the president thinks the mission not worthwhile, that is against the president's own better judgment, here we are 40% of U.S.-based respondents adopting that supremely deferential position. The same thing is basically true with another critical aspect of democratic civil military relations. Do you think that that senior military officers should get involved publicly in policy debate? Democratic civ mil says they should be consulted behind closed doors, but in public, right, where they can be shifting the political debate in their direction, like when General Colin Powell wrote an op-ed in the New York Times opposing deploying peacekeepers to Bosnia, that is a violation of democratic civil military relations norms. And we found that people generally support the military getting involved in those kinds of public debates, utterly contrary to what democratic civ mil would have us believe. We also asked questions that tried to, as you were asking, Gabe, get at changes over time. In 1998, 53% of people agreed, only 53%, that civilians should make the final call. We found that number, 25 years later, not even 25, but 20 years later, had declined significantly, had declined to about 43% of respondents in 2021 said that. So we are not only seeing significant deference, but significantly more deference over time.
Great. And Scott, I want to ask you sort of a follow-up question to one of the points you made and then shift the conversation a bit to trust. Can you speak to, do civilians that work for the government in an official capacity, do they get any formalized training that you know of?
Well, I think the interesting notion, right, is that your first disposition is to train civilians as though they don't have opinions of their own that are formed from their own expertise, and that's what they're selected to be in the position from. And so before getting into that concept exactly, I more want to split out what civilians actually look like across the country, because much of the civil literature actually conflates types of civilians. There's the U.S. electorate, which is a group of civilians that seeks to influence policy through elected officials. But then there are the elected officials, which hold different responsibilities and rights and authorities over the military. The Constitution speaks to these roles explicitly. And so once you then look at what's going on at the elected level, there's an inherent tension that our Constitution frames out. The Congress, the Article 1 branch, has different powers than the president, the Article 2 branch. But the president now, or the presidency, has now evolved to a point where it's not just the president making decisions. The president has a cadre of appointed officials at different tiers and levels working within the Department of Defense. There are the traditional Senate-confirmed appointees that we all think about, but then there's also non-career SES members, Schedule C members that all told end up where there's a couple hundred people representing the president at any point in time in different levels, layers of OSD or the service branches. And so at what point then are you interacting? So you mentioned DOD civilians. I'm one of them. I would not put myself in the category of a political appointee, nor would I think I'm a representative of the military, nor a member of Congress. So where am I in this dichotomy of someone who works in the organization, does not have a military background, but you know, I'm doing my best to stick around for a while and be a part of the organization long term?
We hope so.
I'm giving it a go. And so at that point in time, where am I in this? I am a technocratic expert that doesn't wear the uniform. Am I not having some sort of institutional loyalty that's being pulled here? I would not view myself as responsive to the president in the sense of a political appointee. He doesn't have at-will ability to fire me. And so the question then becomes, when we think about where are we granting deference and to whom, at what layer are we talking? So like Lloyd Austin represents the president. He serves at the pleasure of the president as the Secretary of Defense. And so he's an extension of the civilian component right now, but his background arguably blurs that somewhat with the military. And so a lot of the divide that is born out of sort of Samuel Huntington's framing of the military wears the uniform and everyone else is a civilian can lead to where the theorizing about the role of society or the role of elected officials gets blurred between the two. And there's a connective tissue that sort of dictates where the overall policy is going to come from, the vehicles through which elected officials take messages and form their policy. And I think that needs a little more unpacking to sort of talk about where trust might enter into this, or where deference becomes a problem or deference is a good thing. And so I'll leave it there and let Ron react or bring him back into the conversation.
Ron, please. Yeah.
I think Scott's point is excellent, right? There are different kinds of civilians, and our thinking about civil-military relations has not usually taken that into account. I think it's fair to say, it's not about training, but it is about, do you have an opportunity and have you taken the time to think about your respective roles? And at least formal military training creates such an opening. I think it's fair to say my understanding is that civilians up and down the chain have not had those formal moments where they are being asked to think about, if national security professionals are thinking about their relationship to the military. We all do better when we're prompted to think about those things in a more formal way. I wanted to return, before we move on, I want to return, Gabe, to a point that you made.
Sure.
In introducing this discussion about our work on deference, in distinguishing between retired and active duty military.
Right, yeah.
It seems, from the perspective of democratic theory, once someone's a retired military officer, they're a private citizen, and they should be able to do whatever they like. And yet, two points. One, as it's often said, when someone retires as a general, they have a new first name for the rest of their lives. And that first name is general. They never stop being a general. They're not purely a private citizen. And that's important, right? They are understood to have an expertise. And there's a reason that, as you pointed out, Republicans and Democrats alike have been seeking the endorsements of senior military officers. Second point is that what I found and what Peter Fever finds in his new book is that the general public makes basically no distinction between retired and active duty. We see essentially the same support or objection to retired and active duty military officers participating in public debate. Peter Fever finds basically the same thing. And that should give us pause, because if the general public is not drawing a distinction, they don't know who's retired and active duty, they don't see any distinction between retired and active duty, then that probably means that we should be thinking about retired military officers, not really as private citizens, because the general public doesn't see them that way in public debate. either. And that is should be worrisome to active duty military officers who are, for the most part, pretty careful in not getting involved in partisan political events and debates.
I think that raises an interesting question, though, about where the electorate's supposed to get information about the military, if not using the heuristic of a title that this person has spent a considerable amount of time in the military. How else do we expect proper democratic accountability through an informed citizenship to go get that information they need to make a decision? Someone has to be the information gatekeeper. And we know we're dealing with shorter and shorter attention spans in a media environment saturated with alternatives to anything that you want. And so how would you go about having an informed electorate that's going to have these simple cues if you don't want them participating in public life? I think that's one of the tricky parts of a retired officer class taking a backseat in discussing military affairs is then who else is there to provide information?
We might draw some distinctions, perhaps, between participating as a lot of the conversation does not, but we might begin to draw distinctions between endorsing political candidates, participating as talking heads and writing op-eds. There was a new article just came out, a rare opportunity, probably unrepresentative sample of flag rank officers and their own views of what kinds of behaviors are acceptable in their retirement or not. Obviously, views run the gamut, according to this piece, not surprisingly. Some people say we shouldn't be doing anything, right? And some see no issue with anything. But of course, most people occupy the muddled middle. And in that muddled middle, I think it's pretty clear there's a lot more discomfort amongst those who responded to the survey, who are probably people who are, again, not representative, who are more uncomfortable endorsing political candidates than they are bringing their lifetime of accumulated expertise into public debate via writing op-eds and serving as talking heads.
I completely agree about there being a spectrum of participation that are more or less politicized. I think even within the realm of being a talking head on television is that the cable news networks now have such a strong partisan connotation, not even saying if it's right or wrong, but you can get visceral responses when you mention a particular network from someone of another partisan. And to think that if you're the expert, because the title you mentioned, they put general in front of their name, but they also will have some senior foreign affairs analyst expert or some title that goes along with it that connotates that they are the news station's expert on the policy. And so I think even when they're appearing in those worlds, they're going to get attached as, oh, this is Fox News's general, or this is MSNBC's general. And to think that in a very, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this politely, but in a vacuum of information where people mostly are uninformed, it's the simple cues that they're going to stick and have heuristics towards that are going to be what ultimately shapes the opinions that are espoused on those programs.
If you're a retired senior military officer, flag officer, it's interesting when we look at UCMJ Title 10, you retain a commission. Like what does that mean? How should that change your relationship to partisanship versus, and then of course, further muddling in the middle there is, you know, reserve officers we see hold very high positions in Congress. Some of our most prominent front-facing senators, you know, these are reserve officers. So obviously that's a highly political partisan position to hold. So how do we make sense of that? I think there's very interesting discussions to be had there. Ron, you had one more, and then I'd like to maybe shift us to a brief chat about trust.
What I was going to say, I think sort of segues us perfectly, right? Because in an environment, Scott, as you're suggesting, in an environment where it is so deeply partisan as it is today, where there are so few people that are crossing political lines on any policy issue, even sort of expert policy debate becomes inherently partisan. It's almost impossible to take a stand on any policy question without being seen as being loyal or disloyal to a particular political party.
Perfect segue. So, Scott, we teach cadets CivMil and Intro to AP, and we talk about the importance of trust and building trust. And on the military side. And, you know, we mentioned what the research says about how public perceptions of that trust can get shaped. And we're starting to talk about politicization of the military, or at least perceptions of the politicization there. So what do we do when trust leads to some of the results we're seeing in Ron's research? When the trust becomes, you know, almost so strong, maybe arguably, I don't think you can say trust can be too strong, but if it leads to deference to military authority, seeing them as the expert, and maybe just a blind trust. And I'm curious your thoughts there on trust and how it may be a contributing factor to these issues of deference. And then Ron, we'll go to you on that too.
So I think it's interesting how you alluded to, like, maybe there is no level of trust that's too high. And I think that's largely because trust is such a charged term. No one is going to argue they want to be the opposite of it. You're not going to have someone say, I want to be untrustworthy. Please do not find me trustworthy. And so the question then becomes, what is that latent concept actually mapping or tracking? And so if it's a general statement about American foreign policy, arguably, it shouldn't be 100%. There are times we have misstepped. There are ways in which we have done things that the public probably perceives as policy outcomes that they wouldn't want. And so, you know, you look at Ron's work where he has the first figure that talks about public confidence in the U.S. military from the 60s up into 2018. You see the greater war on terror is where this partisan split begins. Now, yes, that's also a time where we have greater polarization into the United States, but we have a near 30-year history preceding that where Republicans and Democrats are not very differentiated in their overall trust. And so I think the first question to think about with trust is, what are we actually mapping here? Is this a confidence in the military, or is this a statement on the U.S. foreign policy? And so if you think about a protracted war where the two parties disagree about whether or not we should be waging war in a particular way, then you might see trust in the military split because it's becoming a statement on the overall foreign policy that the U.S. government's taking, because people are putting that sentiment of their feelings towards the military onto the overall actions that the military are taking. They're not differentiating whether or not they think the military is trustworthy in this abstract sense, as, you know, the barrier isn't like, are they weighing, will the military conduct a coup today or not? It's a broader commentary on probably larger things going on with the American politic, that they're conflating the military itself with the policy that the military is tasked to carry out.
Great. I think that's that final point there about conflating those two, would foot stomp that. So, Ron, returning to maybe some specifics in your research, you know, you find that Americans don't all trust the military to the same degree and for the same reasons. So what do we know about these partisan dimensions of trust in the military and of their view of civil military relations, both deference to the armed forces and people's attitudes towards officers' roles in these policy debates?
I think it'll surprise no one to hear that those who self-identify as Republicans and conservatives are more likely to trust the military. And I think it will surprise no one to hear that the reason that people generally trust the military is that they think that the military is extremely good at what it does. They think the military is highly ethical, and they think that the military is highly patriotic. To the degree that people distrust the military, they are most likely to distrust the military because they think the military is quite political. And of course, that's a charged term, because what exactly would a political military look like? They're operating in a deeply political environment known as Washington, and they are a political actor seeking to get their way in a deeply political environment. Part that we found really surprising is that we just looked at simple cross-tabulations of the data, and we found that, quite to our surprise, in 2019, those who were most distrustful of the military were also those who were most deferential to the military. And that sounds on its face to be really surprising. Except when you take a step back and realize, wait a second, those who are most distrustful of the military are also those who are likely to be most self-identify as Democrats, most likely to be self-identified liberals, and to rank highest on distrust of the political leader at the time, or the president at the time, Donald Trump. And our and those who were in fact most trusting of the military were least deferential toward the military. And our inference was that those who distrust the military say, we distrust the military, but you know who we distrust even more? Donald Trump. And that they saw the military as a check on a politician whose judgment they fundamentally distrusted. What we see sort of similar patterns when we compare questions that we reproduced from other surveys that show that the American body politic basically has no principled commitment to democratic civil military relations. It's not rooted in ideology. It's rooted largely in their understanding of politics. We made one strong prediction based on the 2019 data. And that strong prediction was that if once Joe Biden was elected, and we finished the article just as it was about to be published just as Biden was elected, we expected a flip. We expected the Democrats, extremely strong Democrats, distrusters of Trump, who were most deferential to the military, should now be least deferential to the military. And we found that Republicans flipped, but only to a very small degree, and Democrats didn't flip at all. In fact, they were more deferential toward the military. This seems to largely be a product of a really surprising shift that took place in the fall of 2020 into 2021, which is that something that we never expected to see anyone, which is that Republicans went from venerating the military to denigrating senior military officers. Lots of accusations about the woke military serving a political agenda within the military. And this had an effect on both Democratic and Republican voters.
Scott, I want to bring you in here. If you want to respond to that more generally, you can. But I would like to get to your Lawfare article. You and your co-authors, you're arguing that the current process for approving senior military officer promotions might lead to some of this increased polarization of the military that we're seeing.
Yeah, so I'll pick up with where Ron left off, just to note that the parties have actually moved quite a lot on their attitudes. I don't think anyone would accuse George W. Bush of having the same foreign policy worldview as Donald Trump. And so the fact that public opinion is malleable as the parties shift really speaks to the strong relationship between voters and their partisanship and how they see the world. And the worldviews that are largely driving behavior are not profoundly rooted in some political or some dimension that's orthogonal to politics. It's not coming from a worldview that's agnostic on whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat. It's largely taking cues from elites on what they are saying their position is and adopting that as my own worldview, which I think speaks to like where are Americans going to get information from. I'll sort of pause there and pivot back to the Lawfare article that just came out to talk about or to give a little context to this. A couple years ago, former Soch faculty member, current major in the Army, scraped a bunch of data on Senate confirmations with general officers. So he had all this information about how long it was taking for general officers to get confirmed by the Senate. And so this is a little different than a political appointee in the sense of the president has is sort of loosely involved in vetting a slate that can go up through the Department of Defense. It's not as though it's routing through the White House like it would for other appointees. But this point, eventually it goes to the Senate floor where the Senate must take a vote to confirm these officers' promotions. And so over the last year, there had been a hold put in place, which is a procedure done by an individual senator where they can slow these nominations because there are so many that go up at this point. The way that they eventually get confirmed is typically a unanimous consent vote, which means one person can say no and they can't do this. And then they have to go through a formal process to actually go through the Senate procedure. I think the estimate was from a CRS report in August that this was something like 300 plus hours of Senate floor time that it would take to confirm these people. I don't know if you keep up too much on the Senate calendar, but they are not in working 300 hour work weeks or anything approximating close
yeah, me
to
neither.
Like a time to clear that slate, given they have lots of other business to take care of. There are many other things.
Yeah,
none of us have 300 hours to just largely be the HR department and do something that everyone is sort of green lighting or rubber stamping. And so we went through and actually looked to see how different this was historically. And in kind, it is different. It's a wholesale block from one individual. But there are historical examples where we have seen individual senators use a hold to stop different nominations and slow different procedures. Interestingly enough, it's typically done in conjunction with stopping political appointees as well that maybe do not share that worldview. And so this brings up a really interesting tension as we think about this process. On its face, we have input from both elected branches picking who will be the general officers. And so that seems like it's good democratic accountability. However, do we think we want general officers that are democratically accountable in a sense that a political appointee or an elected official is? Or are they doing something now that is so technically advanced and requires so much skill that we should be better thinking of these people as merit employees? Senator Reid even used that phrase in discussing the holds over this debate this last year. And so merit employees has a very different connotation. If we think about civil service protection, we've had the Pendleton Act in the 1800s. We've done the Hatch Act. We had a Civil Service Reform Act. We've been slowly giving protections to protect rank and file members of the civil service. And so we need to think about in the civil military frame, where in the spectrum do we think general officers fall? Do we think that they are merit employees that require certain protections? Do we think they fall closer to political appointees? Because right now, other than the DOD handling the slate and coming from a pool of 06s that could get promoted up, serving at the pleasure of the president where you can be relieved by an administration, describes a political appointee. Having your job contingent on a Senate vote describes a political appointee. And so this is just inherently inviting political actors to do political things as it relates to the military. And it might be that our desires for democratic accountability through this process outweigh the politicization costs that we're paying, or it might not be. And we should have that debate and discuss whether or not we think these are merit employees that require merit protections like we've given much of the other parts of the federal government, or do we need a level of accountability that differentiates general officers in a way that actually makes them more political? Because putting the Senate vote in place, putting the president in place for selection is inviting politics into personnel decisions. And when you invite politics into personnel, you are going to politicize the agency.
Ron, I want to bring you in here because you kicked us off with a great explanation of why democratic accountability is central to the right to be wrong thing that we started with. But it also matters here, and Scott framed that very well, about democratic accountability versus the sort of potential political cost, or maybe the potential for politicization is the cost or the price we pay for maintaining a strict adherence to that democratic accountability. So to kind of circle back to that discussion, I want to bring you in on your thoughts there.
Yeah, these are great questions. And that's a really interesting formulation, Scott. You're the expert on bureaucracy. We might sort of broaden this out. The American system is cross-nationally really unusual in how deep our political appointees go. So when you're making a point about appointment to general officers, I'd say that sounds roughly parallel to how deep political appointees go throughout the bureaucracy. And again, that same trade-off between expertise and politicization. And of course, the huge numbers of political appointee slots that simply never get filled or are filled in a very, very desultory fashion when a new administration comes into office. So my inclination would be a little bit with, I think, what you were implying, but I think it goes well beyond the military. That is, a one-star is not making policy in the same way that a three-star is. And in the same way in which you might say, look, a three-star, maybe there should be essentially treated like a political appointee, that the civilians, in order for them to have the right to be wrong, are entitled to have people at the very highest levels who basically they have a real connection with and real trust with. And don't necessarily, are not really merit, don't need merit protections. They're not civil service. But then we should think about that as we think about the assistant secretaries and the deputy assistant secretaries, sure, who are political appointees. And should that really go all the way down? I think that cross-national conversation is something that's often missing from discussion of American civil-military relations in general. And so I'd like to maybe segue to that for just a moment. When we think about trust in the military, we think we often have this really parochial American conversation. But in fact, the United States is not nearly as unusual as we think. Trust in the military around the world is extraordinarily high. We don't know about whether publics in general are deferential to the military around the globe because, frankly, no one's asking the question. But we are asking questions about trust. And we have data going back about 25 years around the world and some places farther back than that. And the US is not as much as an outlier as we often think. Across the democratic industrialized world in particular, across the West, we've had falling trust in political institutions in general that goes hand in hand with paralysis of our political institutions. Since the 1980s, we've been seeing the judicialization of politics. When political institutions are stalled, people turn to to the judicial system to try to break that deadlock and to try to make policy. But the other side of that, the one institution that is also aspirationally apolitical, that is, at least it legitimates itself in apolitical terms, is the military. And so, lo and behold, as we've had a declining trust in political institutions around the globe, we see rising trust, at least in the military, at least if the military doesn't get too involved in politics. And so I have an article that has not yet been published. Oddly, no one has done this yet, that in fact finds an inverse relationship between trust in other political institutions and trust in the military. And I think that this is not just a product of people's general approach to foreign policy, but rather it is because of a very conscious political strategy on the part of politicians around the globe, that as their own legitimacy declines, they have an incentive to promote trust in the military and to swathe themselves in the trust in the military.
Very, very interesting. All right. So, Scott, we've got the comparative perspective a little bit, and we'll certainly get more from Ron's forthcoming work. Can you give us maybe a comparative perspective of trust here as maybe the Americanist on the call here, like comparing us between, I say us, the military, to other bureaucratic organizations in trust, and then even to circle it back to some of your work as you were talking about political appointees, like are there proper, reasonable analogs in the military to someone appointed to a position in, say, the EPA? Like, can you give us maybe the comparative perspective from within the US across bureaucratic organizations?
Sure. I mean, so I think at least in terms of statute, the way to think about it is if you go look where the Secretary of Defense is called out to exist, it's alongside the other cabinet departments, it's the chairman of the Fed. It's put in a position where the civilian positions within the DoD sit alongside every other equivalent position in the federal government. And so that the military wants something different out of the Secretary of Defense arguably is the military wanting the Secretary of Defense to adopt its policies. And it's not a proper weighting of what are presidents going through when they're trying to make this decision. And there's a literature on this within the American politics literature talking about a competency loyalty trade-off. Every appointee that a president chooses between is making a trade-off between how loyal that person will be to the president's policy positions, juxtaposed against their competency to make sure that the agency does its job. Because really, the federal government is a giant blame machine for the president. Anytime something goes wrong, it's going to fall back on the president. You'll never see a headline, "All planes successfully land today." You will not see the USDA catches all forms of E. coli on their screens. What do you hear? You hear, "We have a problem with our food supply," or you'll hear about any sort of calamity that's produced by government falling back on the administration. And so presidents are making a trade-off between wanting someone to speak for them across a huge, huge entity where they can't possibly be in every room for every decision. That's why we delegate authority to the appointees to speak on behalf of the president. And you have to weigh that against having someone with enough expertise to make sure things don't go poorly. Because the way we find out largely that the public sector entities are failing, unlike a business where if you make a bad widget, you end up going out of business because no one buys it, largely public sector entities will persist until they get hit by something exogenous and we get revealed to them that there's a failure. And so we learn about the problems at FEMA when Hurricane Katrina hits. We learn about the problems in government coming about because of some exogenous shock. And the scary part about the military is that the exogenous shock will be losing a war. It'll be losing on the battlefield. And so you always want to be persistently avoiding that and thinking about how best to avoid it. But the trade-off that is being made at the political level from the civilian appointees is one that is not the same game that the military once played. And if you look back to Fever's description about assessing the merits of the military's action and juxtapose it against what the civilians are weighing, the costs of new things for the Department of Defense comes at the expense of other government programs. It's coming in a trade-off. At least it's not wholly zero sum, but it's at least pitted as if I spend one place, I can't spend as much somewhere else. And so this game that civilian elected officials are playing is just not the same thing that the military is doing. So there is going to be a friction. There is going to be a tension that draws across the two. And to Ron's point about the United States, we have a lot more political appointees in our government than anybody else. There's just a lot more of them. And so given that there are so many more, the question is, what are we getting for that? And is it necessary? Because we are different in size and scope, at least in terms of the Department of Defense, than lots of other countries as well.
Okay. Ron, I want to let you reply to that really quick, and then we'll move to final thoughts here as we wrap up.
My only very brief point, I think Scott has brought a really important perspective, which is very rare, in fact, almost unheard of, in the civil-military relations literature, that is thinking of the military as just another bureaucracy within the U.S. government. And I think that's really important. But I also want to push back against it just a little bit. I think it contains really fascinating insights. But we also shouldn't lose sight of the fact about why we have a literature on civil-military relations that perhaps is distinct from our literature on principal-agent problems in bureaucracies. Those dynamics exist, those tensions exist, and Scott is right to raise them. But I think there are two things that make the military different so that we can have this conversation, but we should recognize that it is distinct. One is that I'm not afraid of moles with green eye shades in the EPA overthrowing the government. They might not always do the will of our democratically elected representatives, but that is not fundamentally the same thing as overthrowing our regimes. They can undercut, right, the policies that those democratically elected officials pursue, hence the insight of principal agent problems, but they don't pose a threat to the entire regime of democracy. And the second, the decisions made by bureaucracy in a variety of ways do ultimately have implications for life and death. What kind of welfare state we provide, what kind of public health system we have, absolutely. But that is not quite the same as holding the power of life and death as directly as the military does, especially over non-US citizens. And so that is also something that makes the military distinct, and is why we have a conversation about civilians have the right to be wrong in a way that we don't even have that conversation about other bureaucracies. Because it's recognized with other bureaucracies, right? The stakes with the military are indeed higher.
I take that point entirely. I think the scope of what the military can do with coercion and force pales in comparison to anyone else. But I would push back a little bit with the notion of, you know, there's Department of Justice and the FBI, where the FBI certainly uses force and deprives life and liberty of U.S. citizens. It's inward facing. And so I think, you know, the different vehicles within the state that use force in ways that we should potentially think about bringing the civ mil literature and theorizing about. I mean, the notion of a police force protesting against the mayor, we're used to seeing those occur. And the idea that if the president walked into the room, the military would all turn their back on the president is anathema to our understanding of what good civ mil relations look like. And so arguably there's a borrowing that should be going on elsewhere in government to talk about what sort of norms are useful to carry forward. And I think that's the, you're exactly right, that we should be well aware of the capacity of what the military has to do to undercut or end democracy. It's just that they're not so unique and solely isolated that they're the only ones with that as
Great
well.
Points. I love it. I could do this forever, but for the sake of our, for our listeners, I'd like to go to just some final thoughts. So Scott, I want to start with you. I'm going to make you king for a day, whatever that means.
That's very dangerous.
All right. So yeah, especially in the context of democracy, right? So what do we change, or do we need to change? Do we change how we educate officers in CivMil, something that you and I are actively involved with? And do we make changes to advice and consent for certain senior military leadership positions? And if you take issue with the fundamental framing of those questions, feel free to say so.
No, so I definitely won't take any issue with it. I think what I would encourage us to think about and discuss and actually legislate and go through a normal channel for are sort of being clear where policy should meet first principles. What are the things that we think are most important with our society? And do the policies that we have today meet and match with those principles? I think a lot of, if you look specifically at the confirmation debate, the discussion that happened over the last year, it was a lot of sort of shame on the senator for doing the thing that the Senate's allowed to do. Like, this is the Senate being a creature of, and I'm not making a commentary on whether I think the decision to have the hold is right or wrong. That's not the way I'm trying to go with this at all. It's more to say that a senator uses a tool of the Senate should not surprise us. If we don't like the outcome that it produces, we should be thinking, what are the principles that we do want? What are the guiding lights that are going to carry us forward, so that then we can articulate policy that matches with what we think those principles ought to be? If we think it is a protection of expertise, then we lean more towards merit principles. If we think we need democratic accountability, where elected officials have more control, then that means a different vehicle, that we just sometimes have to be okay with politics making things messy. I mean, no one likes the sausage getting made as a viewer of the process. And that's just the nature of politics, though. I mean, you look at surveys of the American public, most people want change. That's a feature going back at least to the Clinton elections in the early 90s. There's been a call for change to take place. And that's just largely a dissatisfaction with people feeling politics is icky. And it probably is. But that we bring something that we think is a little distasteful into something we want to keep pristine, I think that's a debate that we should have as to where on the spectrum we want protections for expertise and where we want democratic accountability.
Awesome. And so, Ron, you were on a civil military relations panel hosted by a podcast called Horns of a Dilemma. I'm a big fan of them and happy to point our listeners in that direction. Last year, I think a little bit earlier in the year, perhaps. And in your concluding thoughts, you said the challenge ahead of us on the civilian side of the civ-mil equation is to find some middle ground between denigration, which you talk about a lot in some of your foreign affairs pieces recently, and maybe sort of this blind patriotism or veneration of military leaders. And of course, the deference issue that you've spoken about on this podcast today. So it's been over a year. How are we doing? What do you think? And then what's the prescription?
Well, I want to sort of both echo a point that Scott just made, and then I want to sort of say something a little bit different. To echo Scott's point, right, we should not be surprised when people are given every incentive to behave in particular ways and then do it, and then we get upset about it. And retired generals going and giving their endorsements to political figures, they want to make a, you know, at the end of the day, they want a prominent seat at the table. They want to make a buck. They're going to go on the networks. We don't have rules against any of that, and no surprise, therefore, they are going to do that. And we shouldn't be upset about that when they follow the rules. One difference is we can actually control what retired generals do, at least if they want their pension check. And that requires some real choices being made by our nation's politicians to change the code and to say, if you do these things, you will not get your pension check, which means that everyone but the greatest of those superstars right, who does says, well, I'll go on CNN because I don't care about my pension check compared to the money I'm getting from CNN and CNBC and Fox News. Everyone else is going to follow their financial incentives and is not going to get involved there. The same thing is true, by the way, with the retired generals going and immediately becoming part of the military industrial complex. If we don't like it, we can change the law. However, there are limits to that. Because one of the lessons I think that we've seen over the years since 2017, and as we approach the prospect of Donald Trump potentially being elected a second time, as he seems almost a sure lock, things can change, but almost a lock for the Republican nomination, and running neck and neck, if not ahead of Joe Biden, as things stand now, is that institutions and policies have a really hard time, are really backed by informal norms. And at the end of the day, we can design the best policies and the best institutions that we want. But when you have a leading political figure who is steadfastly determined to undermine them and to undermine all checks on their authority, fundamentally, they can do it. Fundamentally, we do not have those institutions and policies will never be strong enough. And that is why ultimately so much of our conversation of civil military relations is hortatory. It's hortatory toward our military officers and it's hortatory toward our civilians, which is essentially do better. Civilians, find a middle course between veneration and vilification. Resist the urge to swathe yourself in the protective blanket of the military. Or alternatively, resist the urge to make the military a punching bag. And we ask our senior officers to resist the urge to play the system the way they can, but to retain an adherence to principle. And so I fully agree with Scott. Let our policies and institutions match our values, and let's not, and if we think there's a problem with them, change the policies, change the institutions. We can do that. But by the same token, we also need to remind people about the values that are at stake, because those institutions and policies, as we've been reminded in the last several years, are actually more fragile than we had long thought.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with others. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any other agency of the U.S. government.